The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
John Harper in for Drew this afternoon. Good afternoon. He's on his way back with Relevant Radio listeners on his pilgrimage to the Holy Land. Can't wait to hear about that journey, and I'm sure he'll be sharing many stories with the Relevant Radio listeners who are fortunate enough to make what I think is our first pilgrimage here at Relevant Radio, and we'll have many more with all of our hosts here, so opportunities for you to literally live the history of the Church in the Holy Land in Rome, in the Eternal City, and I'm sure many other pilgrimages that are being planned. So stay tuned for information on that. And I'm sure when the pilgrims get back, they will share pictures, as you probably have on social media. And you've probably been on social media at some point in time during the day. And the people that you follow outside of your family and friends, sometimes, and even family and friends really can influence how you view the world. Is that necessarily a good thing for us as Catholics? Father Simon started to talk about that just a few minutes ago here on Relevant Radio, and we'll go in depth on that in just a few minutes here on the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. But let me bring you up to date on a couple of things that are going on. This is a sound that we do not like to present to you, and it is more bombing in Kyiv in the Ukraine. It's another day and another round of blasts. Those are coming from Russian suicide drone attacks. Not only in Kyiv, but across the Ukraine, the capital's central district, among the hardest hit as it's been over the weekend. This is Mayor Vitaly Klitschko of Kyiv.
Russians, they destroyed our country. They destroyed our hometown. They killed civilians right now.
18 people were rescued from the rubble of one building. Ukraine leaders are continuing to ask us here in the United States and those in the West to send more air defense help. Ukrainian ambassador to the United States, Oksana Markovrova, told CBS's Face the Nation that everything to get weapons to the Ukraine is being done.
Unfortunately, these systems are difficult to produce, and they're not ready on the shelves waiting, but we're doing everything possible and asking our partners to do everything possible to speed up not only the delivery, but ordering of the systems.
And France is the latest country to send some air defense systems over to the Ukraine in its war with Russia. The nuclear power plant in Ukraine was taken off the grid. This was after more Russian shelling, and of course that could create another energy crisis for the region in the coming months. Well, there are 3 weeks to the midterms, 3 weeks from tomorrow. There are brand new polls out today from CBS and the New York Times that show a decided shift to Republicans taking the House of Representatives. Still, Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee says take the polls with a grain of salt because very often people do not answer the questions of pollsters honestly.
They don't want to talk about exactly how they're going to vote because maybe they're a member of a union. Maybe they're afraid that they're being polled by people that they work for.
Democrats and Republicans have coalesced behind their individual candidates. The biggest change in the last month is independents. It's an 11-point shift of independents going towards GOP candidates. Here's some good news, bad news this afternoon on the Drew Mariani Show, and it's about our wallets. The good news is the supply chain issues are better than they were last time, this year, last year, and so that means Christmas shopping should be a little easier. Kathy Thomas runs the Good Things Boutique in St. Paul, Minnesota.
We had a little bit issues with stock last year with, you know, a lot of stores did, but like I said earlier this year, it seems like everything has come that isn't coming, and this is only the beginning.
Well, that's the good news. Of course, the bad news is something that you and I have been dealing with for the last several months, and that's inflation. Shopper Carla Salinas is just like about half of us who are saying, you know what, it's going to be harder to afford Christmas this year.
It's hard because diapers are expensive, formula's expensive. We're not going to give gifts because we're so tight on money right now that it's either I buy groceries or I buy gifts.
Either buy groceries or buy gifts. Online spending is up 2.5 points. I know that sounds good, but that's the lowest pace since 2012. You're trying to sell your house. Well, you've probably dropped the asking price because now the housing market's cooling off. Sales are down 29% in the last year. Mortgage rates are the reason. 30-year fixed mortgage, 7%. It's the first time it's been that high in 15 years. That's because the Federal Reserve has been aggressively hiking rates to curb inflation. Wow, 7%. And perhaps you're hearing Relevant Radio just a little bit better today because you have a new hearing aid. It's not the expensive prescription hearing aids, but the ones you can now buy in the big box stores, in the retail stores. And this is thanks to the FDA. They've approved Walmart, other big box stores like Walgreens, Best Buy to sell hearing aids. Get a pair for as low as $199. No prescription, no hearing assessment, no medical exam or fitting required, though you can consult a doctor. And health officials say this is going to help. An estimated, this is an amazing number, 80% of Americans have hearing loss. 80% of Americans have hearing loss. And because of this, they can now get some help because the price of prescription hearing aids is not as high as it used to be. Some as high as $5,000. One day I'll tell you the story about the fight with my mom to get a hearing aid. And they're now saying that if you've got hearing problems early on, that could also offset dementia later on in your life. We'll get to that at another day, at another time. But that's some good news. If you need a hearing aid, you can go in the big box stores and get them a little bit cheaper. It's the Drew Mariani Show here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. We were talking about social media, and I know many of you connect to us on our Twitter page, on our Facebook page, on Instagram as well. But remember, especially if you're a certain age, social media meant getting together with family and friends in person, right? You would have a meal or you would pick up something called the telephone, and that's when it was physically attached to a wall with a cord on that. Well, social media today is really anything, as you know, from Facebook to Twitter to TikTok to any number of platforms in which you and I communicate. What started out as something where you just kind of posted pictures of your kids, your pets, what you had for lunch, has turned into a way to influence what often are partisan-fueled debates about how you feel, and that can get you in trouble.
Kanye West, who now goes by just Ye, has offered to buy right-wing social media company Parler for an undisclosed amount. He was booted from Twitter and Instagram a week ago over anti-Semitic posts that they said violated their terms of service. Parler CEO George Farmer on Mornings with Maria on Fox Business said that's when he came to them.
He said that free speech is an inalienable right. You know, free speech is something that we all must strive towards. He's very excited about this.
Thank you, Fox News, for that report. Kanye West, who legally changed his name to Ye, Y-E, reached an agreement in principle to purchase Parler, which is popular among supporters of former President Donald Trump. Now, why Parler? Well, the platform started getting a name for itself a couple of years ago during the election in 2020 as a friendly gathering place for conservative politicians and pundits. James Chernofsky is a senior policy analyst in technology and innovation at Americans for Prosperity, putting this story in perspective. James, welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show.
Thanks for having me.
A big picture question, and this does not mean to be disparaging. Why would anyone care what Kanye West thinks, what I think, what anybody thinks on social media?
It's a fair question. It's one that I find myself asking all the time, but for some reason, when you're in a position of power where you have a lot of clout because you're Ye or you're Elon Musk, people seem to care what you think and say and do. If you're Taylor Swift, I have lots of friends that are Swifties, right? It puts them in a very weird position where, you know, a lot of people are invested in hearing these people's thoughts. So that's why you see them caring a little bit more about what these people are doing.
Father Simon today on his program was talking about it, and he says, you know what? These are entertainers. These are entertainers. They were viewed as someone just a notch above those in the oldest profession, Father Simon said, winking into the microphone. And he said that's probably the case today. So again, why should we give them any credibility? And Father was saying that we really should be in step with the justice and mercy of God. And as Catholics, that's another filter that perhaps we don't think about, but we should. When we look at who the influences are on social media, especially when you look at the influences on you and how you might be living your life, right, James?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, like with anything that you find on the internet, you should always be taking it with a grain of salt and making decisions that make best sense for you and your personal life. And the nice thing is that, like, broadly speaking, that does apply, particularly like in political context. So, like, you know, whenever a celebrity goes to endorse like some particular political candidate that they like, empirically speaking, doesn't necessarily have like a statistically significant impact on the voting record that ultimately comes out in those instances. So at least like we do get it to a degree And it would be nice to see that extend to other areas. But that being said, like, there is like some net positives too, like where I think that you do want them to be influencing people. Insofar as, like, again, outside of Ye's other problems that he currently is experiencing, you know, the man was obviously a widely and hugely successful rapper. And that's like something that's very inspirational for somebody that wants to break into the music industry in terms of just figuring out how they might want to go about doing that and listening into those stories of how these people got to where they were. Like, I think like those kinds of ways of influencing is very insightful and things that we should encourage, and a little bit less so about like what you should be wearing, who you should be voting for, things in that direction.
And that's the direction that a lot of these posts do go in. And of course, just, you know, be discerning. It's a message that, you know, we share a lot on this radio program, is to be discerning. Ask the Holy Spirit for some guidance here as well. There's a double-edged sword here, James, with social media. Number one, it's kind of brought us together, and it is also, it's the modern electronic version of the old general store Cracker Barrel, where you got together and you talked about issues of the community. Now, the community is however you want to define it on social media now. So in a sense, that's good. But the other side of the sword is, I'm only seeking out those who share my views. So the discourse about what's going on, or the potential of opening my mind to other viewpoints, has been erased for the most part with social media. Would you agree with that?
Yes and no. I think that we've certainly seen a lot. I agree with your point that there certainly is a lot more ability for people to connect with one another and really coalesce around some shared common values in some areas of their lives. I think that that's been a huge boon as a millennial who's grown up as a digital native and many of these services. I think that that's something that I can appreciate. It's helped me go and meet people that share the same passions that I do. And that's great. I think, you know, to your point about us not like, you know, necessarily agreeing on those more politically charged topics, that's something that's always been there. It's just that that's gotten exacerbated over time as, you know, there's frustrations that build up with our way of dealing with these issues, with the democratic process of electing people to represent us. And if things don't get done in a fast enough pace, like people want solutions today, not in 30 years, that creates a whole different set of incentives and problems that we have to deal with. And it makes it very frustrating, and it pushes people a little bit more towards the edges of the political spectrum, and that can present other unique problems. So I think that there's definitely a lot of good. There's definitely some bad. But it's just very important for people to remember that the internet's not real life. As much as we like to look at Twitter as like a quote unquote town square, the reality is that only about 25% of Americans have a Twitter account, and only a fraction of that fraction are generating over 90% of all the Twitter activity that we see on a daily basis. And that's not real life, right? I like to think that our local communities have a lot more conversations than we do on Twitter. So that's just something to keep in the back of your head always in this space.
And thank you for that perspective, because when you look at the 24/7 news cycle, they're taking a tweet and turning it into a headline for a 24-hour period, and thus elevating something that only 25% of Americans even see, fewer participate in. So again, there's that perspective as we talk about social media today and the explosion of social media, but more importantly, how we look at social media. The latest influencer is Ye, the artist formerly known as Kanye West, who legally changed his name buying Parler for an undisclosed amount of money. And money is really behind this in our conversation here with James Chernowski, who is a senior policy analyst at Americans for Prosperity, because Parler saw its monthly visits plunge about 83% this year. And they're looking at Ye, formerly Kanye West, signing a deal with Adidas, which is a collaboration that generates something like $2 billion in revenue. So this is a money grab more than anything else, isn't it?
Oh, you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, for Ye, it's partly that he wants someplace where he can feel like he can express himself. But two, it's just one of those things where I think that it is a thing, because you don't want to just waste money and blow it on supporting something that's not successful, right? You want to build out something that can go and stand the test of time. And, you know, frankly, even though, again, like, we keep thinking of, like, Twitter as big tech, it's the most dysfunctional one that's out there insofar as that It has struggled to get revenue and be profitable. And you can only be what you can afford to be in this day and age. And Twitter cannot afford to be the kind of company that it was. And therefore, we saw it getting bought right now by Elon Musk. That deal's back on. So it's actually, I think, a little bit more positive in the sense of, like, if the conversations about trying to restore, like, a semblance of better communications online, perhaps these kinds of things could go and make that more of a reality than what's currently out there. But at the end of the day, yeah, like, it's only possible to make that a reality if these companies are able to become larger, more successful, more profitable, et cetera.
Whom do you follow on social media? 888-914-9149. Your kids, your grandkids. Some of the people that they follow on social media. Why do they do that? Why do you follow the people that you do on social media? How do they influence you? 888-914-9149 here on the Drew Mariani Show. 888-914-9149 in our conversation with James Chernowski, the senior policy analyst of Americans for Prosperity. Part of the reason why Ye, formerly Kanye West, is buying Parler is because he was thrown off some of the other platforms for apparently suggestive or questionable content. That said, isn't social media still a real free speech haven? Because there really are minimal rules. We've seen any number of viewpoints shared on social media that have gone viral, whether they're true or not.
You're absolutely right. I think that it's something that's underappreciated about American speech online is that regardless of how you feel about the various decisions these technology companies make, and make no mistake, they've certainly, I think, made some bad calls over the years. It doesn't change the fact that nowhere else in the world, bar none, will you have anywhere that you can go and speak as freely online. I just think back to what's happened in Hong Kong in the past year. I think about Australia, where a woman was thinking about organizing a protest over the lockdowns, and she got arrested when she was going to get a prenatal checkup for her baby that was expected in the near future. Like, that's the kind of, you know, speech restriction that we don't necessarily see here in the United States, and that's something that we got to appreciate. And at least in my opinion, it's actually pretty easy to stay online if you're not going and engaging in incendiary remarks. You mentioned Kanye getting booted off the platforms. It was because Kanye sat there and put out, you know, content, like you said, that was questionable, but it was varying into grounds that were more like anti-Semitism. And not for nothing, I don't think that's something that we want to see encouraged anywhere, especially when you're talking about, to your point about influencers that can have a negative consequence. If you're putting out anti-Semitic remarks and you're somebody that's as popular as Ye is, you don't think that that increases the likelihood that perhaps Jewish people might face an increased, you know, probability of having violence or negative espousements thrown at them. I think that that's not an unrealistic thing to expect. And we've already seen that pop up in droves in some instances. So right. I think that it's very important that we try to reinforce those ground rules and have those positive conversations, because we don't want to see anti-Semitism sprouting about online in these popular, areas where we have these discourses. And that's the nice thing, is that right now these platforms have that flexibility to engage in those kinds of decisions, but there's lots of regulatory proposals out there that would certainly go and strap down on their ability to engage in those kinds of decisions, and that would be very bad.
James, as you followed social media, and really from the early days of America Online when there were chat rooms to where we are today, does it surprise you that our ability, and I know I'm using a broad brush here, our ability to discern, to think for ourselves, seems to have waned? If we did a graph, think for yourself would be the line going down. Social media thinking for us is the line that's going up. I mean, how do we put that toothpaste back in the tube to just simply empower people to say, you know what, you can think for yourself?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that there's at least some positive news on that front in terms of, like, with younger generations. I think that they're certainly more open towards being able to tackle information, let's say, that's not credible, and being able to look at multiple things. But as a general point, I think the broader problem there is that you're referencing more of a cultural schism where people don't agree on what the basic set of facts are, and then they go and retreat into echo chambers. And that becomes very problematic for sure. Is it possible to go and rein some of that back in? Absolutely. I think I'm admittedly more of an optimist in this area. I want to see that happen because I think that our ability to agree to disagree is actually one of the things that makes this country one of the best out there. You know, and I think that it certainly is possible to get it back into the tube, but it's a hard conversation to have, because then that means that you have to be willing to accept not being comfortable with the outcome of all your conversations. You're not always going to be able to move people to your view of things. And as somebody who works in politics and who covers tech policy every day, that's my conversation every day. And it's a great pleasure, but it's also very hard and daunting in many ways to have to go and relitigate the same things time and time again. But ultimately, I think it's worthwhile. So I think that we can get there.
And it's a business model in the United States. You know, the 24/7 news cycle, you can go to any number of cable opinion networks and, again, go to where you're most comfortable, as you are on social media as well. And, you know, you can, you know, you can curse those who don't share the same viewpoint with you, but there's big business at the other end of that. So that's a business model that's not going to go away. If anything, it will only grow moving forward.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And I think that more often than not, when we're talking about these problems that you've raised, it is impossible to ignore the role that traditional media companies have played in shaping the way that we're seeing certain discourses, you know, develop online. If everything that's there is about generating some kind of, you know, conflict, some kind of disagreement, some kind of hot take, shifting to more, you know, politically oriented style of covering things, that's not a surprise that we're in an online discourse, to your point, where we're seeing people not necessarily have those healthy conversations that we otherwise want to see happen online. So the solutions that have to be out there are a lot broader than just looking at online spaces. We also have to look at how we're dealing with things in the traditional media arena as well.
Who do you follow on social media?
Who do I follow on social media? Oh, man, I'm all over the place. Obviously, I follow Elon Musk because that man has been keeping me busy lately with his Twitter acquisition. But, you know, it's all over the place. I follow some people for the New York Giants because I'm a huge football fan of my New York Giants. They're 5-1.
How about that, huh?
Yeah, I know. Biggest surprise.
They're talking about really. Yeah, I'm here in New York, and we always say God's a God of surprises, but the New York Giants with their record this year, that's surprising even the most diehard Giants fans.
Yeah, exactly. So really, it's all over the place, really. And then that's why I love social media, because I can go and follow the New York Giants people. I can go and follow my tech policy people. I can go and follow my friends from the video game industry that I've worked with over the years. And it's really a great way to get to have a consolidated place for me to have access to all those different groups that I operate with on any given day of the week. So that's my favorite part about it. So whether it's Elon Musk or, you know, looking at certain politicians on Twitter, or looking at my New York Giants players operating on Twitter, it's always fun.
I know I shouldn't ask you this with 60 seconds to go here, but Elon Musk, if thumbs up, thumbs down, Elon Musk buying Twitter, good thing for Twitter and social media, bad thing for Twitter and social media, or it's just going to stay the same?
I think that it's going to change a little bit, but not as much as Democrats fear or as much as Republicans would like to hope. So I think that on average, it's the best for all parties.
James Chernowski, thank you for the perspective. Senior Policy Analyst, Americans for Prosperity. We appreciate it. Where can we follow you on social media? Silence is that. He went away. I'm sure you can find him up on social media. By the way, every time we talk about social media, we always add that every one of the Psalms fits in a tweet. So imagine if you did every one of the Psalms in a tweet every single day as you went through all of the Psalms. What kind of conversation that would start? I'll just put that seed there for you to plant, maybe, on your social media and watch what happens. John Harper for Drew Mariani this afternoon here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Your news. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Your news now.
This hour sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More info, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
The Drew Mariani Show is on Relevant Radio.
John Harper for Drew this afternoon. You've heard us talk about Vatican II. lately here on the Drew Mariani Show, and it really is the foundation, if you're a baby boomer, of who we are as Catholics today, and we have raised another generation or two of Catholics under Vatican II. In a nutshell, what it did back in the early 1960s from Pope John the 23rd, and continuing with Pope St. Paul the VI, is it really opened up the windows of the church, if you will, to let in fresh air. There are all those analogies and all of those sometimes cliches that we use. And of course, it updated the liturgy, the role of lay people. You know how your role is in your parish. That's what Vatican II helped open. And it also introduced the concept of religious freedom. It really also started a dialogue with other religions. Let's look a little bit at Vatican II right now, and also its effect on religion, Catholic religion as well, Catholic education as well, and the teaching of our faith. Monsignor James Patrick Shea is joining us. He is a member of our family here at Relevant Radio and the president of the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota. Monsignor, good afternoon.
Good to be with you, John. How are you doing today?
We're blessed to have you on. There is, again, as I was saying, when we look at the chronology of Vatican II from the early 1960s to today, we've got generations of Catholics, really the foundation of the church, based on Vatican II. Some disagree with what's in Vatican II, and some say that really did revolutionize the church at a time when we needed to revolutionize the church. That was the vision of John the 23rd and also Paul the VI, but also 57 years ago. As a matter of fact, almost to the day coming out of the Second Vatican Council was a document on not only Catholic culture, but Catholic education as well. And when you read through that, it's written in a very conversational way for something that is a document that comes out of the Vatican, Monsignor, that really sounds like a conversation that perhaps you and I would have about the foundation of education at the University of Mary, or really any Catholic school here in the United States.
Right, John. Well, the question of Vatican II has been much in the air in recent weeks. You know, just last week on the 11th of October, we remembered the 60th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council, and we had a convocation here on campus at the University of Mary in commemoration of that. Of course, the council was opened, as you said, by Pope St. John the 23rd with an address called Gaudet Mater Ecclesia, Mother Church Rejoices. And I was very moved, I have to tell you, to go back and to read that document, which Pope St. John the 23rd read in proclamation at the beginning of the Second Vatican Council, and the vision that he had at the beginning of the council. You know, he was sitting there just above the tomb of St. Peter, and he was surrounded by all the bishops in the world who had been convened to that place. And he made a couple of very important points, I think. It's important for us to remember from an historical point of view, John, that that there was a certain optimism in the air. You know, he was there with all the bishops after that horrific 30-year period between 1914 and 1945, which had seen the countries of Europe turn against each other in suicidal fury. And more than 100 million people die violent deaths, and dark ideologies and ways of thinking rising up out of the ground of Western culture. And so I think that Pope John was considering what the possibilities were for a new renewal of interest in questions of faith. And he was right to a certain extent. I mean, in the years, in those early 60s and late 50s, there was a renewed interest in traditional morality. People were going back to church in larger numbers, and Italy and France and Germany all were ruled by serious Christian statesmen. You know, there was that optimism in the air that he was trying to channel. But in addition to that, in Gaudet Mater Ecclesiae, he made it clear that he wasn't trying to dismantle anything. The purpose of the council would not be a departure from the deposit of faith. It wouldn't be to disrupt Catholic life and worship and practice in significant ways. That wasn't the founding intention or the summoning intention of the Second Vatican Council. What he made clear in Gaudet Mater Ecclesiae is that what he was trying to do and what he believed that the Holy Spirit was calling for was for a rearticulation of perennial and ancient truths in a way that the modern world could hear again for the first time. In other words, we were living and are living in a civilization which, by a slow and steady process, is secularizing, is ridding itself of its Christian bases. And so years later, Cardinal Francis George, you know, who was the great Archbishop of Chicago, would say that Vatican II was a limited accommodation to modernity in non-essentials for the sake of evangelization. And so the point of Vatican II, also in its document on Catholic education, was to speak the perennial, changeless gospel in a new way for the modern era.
And also, Monsignor Shea, as we look at what has come out of Vatican II, now some 60 years later, we have to be reminded that there's tremendous continuity through the history of the modern church since John the 23rd, because Benedict the 16th was at Vatican II. So when you connect the dots, you see that there is a tremendous continuity of the message.
Well, so that, you know, there are different polls. You had mentioned that the Second Vatican Council is controversial, and that there are people who disagree with the council, and that certainly is the case. You know, Catholic life in the years since Vatican II in the last 60 years have basically has congregated around three different poles. Of course, this is an oversimplification, but there's kind of a progressivist pole, which sort of a group of people who would say that the council didn't go far enough, and that really what we need to do is not look at the texts of the council, but look at the spirit of the council, because that'll get us to sort of the radical.
We're having some difficulty connecting with, we're using modern technology here. And, there we go. We're back with you.
Sorry.
We use modern technology where Monsignor, by the way, happens to be on a mobile phone, but we've invested in the technology here in our new studios at Relevant Radio to make it sound like he's right here. And, you know, with anything digital, it's all digital. It's either 100% there or not there, but you're 100% with us, always in spirit, but now in voice as well. Go ahead.
Sorry about that. Where did I cut off, John?
Well, we were talking a little bit about the continuity of the message from John the 23rd through Benedict, who was at Vatican II.
Yeah, let me cut to the chase, because probably what was happening is the Holy Spirit throughout the
Listen, Monsignor, I just wanted to jump in here because the technology is not cooperating with us today, and we'll reconnect with you perhaps on the telephone as well, because there's also so much to talk about with Vatican II, because if you were, and it depends on your age, because I have one foot in the, quote, old catechism. These are the labels that we used to use in the new catechism, right? And if you're a baby boomer, you've probably had one foot in Baltimore Catechism, and I received my first Holy Communion out of the Baltimore Catechism, still got my copy. Recommend, if you don't have a copy of the Baltimore Catechism, as a cradle Catholic, get one. Get one for your kids and let them read it, especially if they're going to CCD classes right now. That's going to be a tremendous eye-opener and a way to talk about faith with you and your kids as well, because that's the quote-unquote old catechism and the new catechism. But you'll see the connections between the two and this renewed vision of what it means to be church by looking at the old, the traditional as well, and the new, if you will. We've reconnected with Monsignor Shea on the good old-fashioned telephone. That still works. We were just talking about, I'm of the age, where I've got one foot in what, and you've heard this, Monsignor, the old catechism and the new catechism, Baltimore Catechism, and the Vatican II Catechism as it was changed. But it really wasn't, because all it was a renewed vision of what it means to be church. Yeah. So there's a learning opportunity, the point that I was making when we were reconnecting with you, for moms and dads whose children may be going through CCD right now, to introduce them to the Baltimore Catechism and see how the quote-unquote old catechism connects perfectly with where we are today.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I'm so sorry about what happened earlier, but I'm glad to be back on the air with you, John. And I think we were talking about this question of continuity. Benedict XVI, John Paul II were both at the Second Vatican Council, and they were keen to make sure that we understood the Council and that the Second Vatican Council is being interpreted according to what they called a hermeneutic of continuity. So you use the word continuity, and that's true. John the 23rd, when he called the Second Vatican Council, didn't want to revolutionize Catholic teaching. The teaching is given to us by Christ. And so I was raised on the Baltimore Catechism, John, and I learned it when I was a young boy, even though I was born in 1975. And so my parents still use the Baltimore Catechism because it's such a beautiful way to teach children the truths of the faith. And then, of course, when I was in seminary, I read the New Catechism, which had been issued by Pope St. John Paul II in the 1990s, and was deeply, deeply edified by the depth of teaching and by its facility and capacity to communicate the faith to the modern era in a clear and effective way. And so, yes, there's a deep continuity, and we shouldn't understand that there's some type of a rupture between what went before and what went after, or what came after. The Second Vatican Council wasn't meant to be an effort to modernize the Church, but to speak the perennial truths, the everlasting truths of the Gospel and the teaching of Jesus and the teaching of the Church into the modern era more effectively.
As we talk about that, and this would be an appropriate place, Monsignor Shea, as we look at what has come out of Vatican II to address what may in some circles be the spiritual elephant in the room, and that is the comments that the Holy Father made last summer about celebrating the Latin Mass. We still do it in my parish. It's still widely done in the diocese in which I reside. But there also seems to be some confusion over the Holy Father's words about celebrating the Latin Mass, which is, again, speaking to continuity. If you've never been to that, even if you don't understand Latin, it is a tremendous way to connect the way we celebrate Mass today with that 1962 Missal. There is a beauty and a reverence to it that allows you to bring that beauty and reverence with you when you walk into your parish moving forward. For the sake of this conversation, we'll use the label, the traditional or the new Mass.
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the most controversial elements of the Council, even though it wasn't a central focus of the Council, did have to do with Sacrosanctum Concilium and its interpretation afterward. Sacrosanctum Concilium was the Council's document on the sacred liturgy. And there were reforms which were made afterward, which have been controversial. And I think part of the controversy comes because the liturgy, in other words, what happens on Sunday when we go to church, is the part of Catholic life which most closely touches the lives of sort of rank and file, all of us who are out here in the wide world trying to live for the Lord and be faithful Catholics. And so, I think, you know, for a long time, after the reforms of the Second Vatican Council and after the reforms of the liturgy which came after the Second Vatican Council, the celebration of the 1962 Missal still took place, but not in a very widespread fashion. And then Benedict XVI issued Summorum Pontificum, which loosened up any regulation upon the traditional Latin Mass of the 1962 Missal. And so that became much more widespread. And the hope of Pope Emeritus Benedict, who was Pope at the time, was that the two rites, what he called the extraordinary form and the ordinary form of the Mass, would speak to each other and influence each other. And so, yes, last summer, Pope Francis issued Traditionis Custodis, in which he once again restricted the use, certainly not completely eliminated it, but restricted the use of the 1962 Missal. I think that a lot of people haven't participated in the Mass, what you would call the New Mass, John, in its Latin form, because, of course, the New Mass can be celebrated in Latin. In fact, was written to be celebrated in the Church's official language of Latin as well. But yeah, I think that there's a whole lot to that conversation. I'm not sure we have time to treat it in a deep and satisfying fashion here.
Right. Monsignor James Patrick Shea, the president of the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota. We're talking about Vatican II some 60 years later and the influence of Vatican II on you as a Roman Catholic man or woman. How old were you when Vatican II and the reforms of Vatican II came to your parish, came to your family? How did you share that with your children, your grandchildren? 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Join our conversation with Monsignor Shea here on the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Insight and analysis right here. It's the Drew Mariani Show, Relevant Radio.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Get caught up on that conversation you missed by going to the Relevant Radio archives. Just select The Drew Mariani Show.
John Harper in for Drew, who returns from pilgrimage in the next couple of days here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. And just a quick reminder, as we fast approach the month of November, we celebrate the lives of our friends and family who have passed away, their entry into the kingdom of heaven. And you can join Relevant Radio through the month of November, actually November 2nd through the 10th, as we offer a novena for the holy souls. So if you have some souls you want us to pray for, you can submit up to 20 names of your departed loved ones. All you have to do is go to relevantradio.com/souls now, all the way up to November 10th. And when you submit the names of those souls to pray for, we'll pray for them daily in the Mass that you hear, along with the Divine Mercy Chaplet with Drew every afternoon, the Family Rosary Across America every night with Father Rocky. Plus, when you sign up, you'll also get these daily reflections from Father Rocky. So again, go to relevantradio.com/souls, relevantradio.com/souls. As we talk about family and a number of other things, some of what came out of Vatican II, the 60th anniversary of Vatican II, our conversation this afternoon with Monsignor James Shea, the president of the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota, and you can always find them at umary.edu, umary.edu, or an easier website is cometomary.com, cometomary.com. And as we look at what came out of Vatican II and how you and I live that today in the church in October of 2022, how did Vatican II affect you and your family? And how have you shared that message with your children? 888-914-9149, our conversation with Monsignor Shea and with Becky in St. Charles, Illinois. Hi, Becky. Welcome to Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. It's more a comment than anything else. I was born in 68, and so I was raised in post-Vatican II church. And what it allowed to happen for my parents was they went through an amazing conversion on that personal Jesus and me level, because that's kind of what rose to the surface, at least where I was. So that was my experience as well, is I was really imbued with this kind of evangelical-ish Jesus and me. I love the Lord. I have a personal relationship with him, but I was very, very poorly catechized. So when I went away to college and I ran into people who spoke my, evangelese language, they were all campus crusaders. They were university people. They were people who didn't get me, and I didn't get them because
oh, we dropped her there. Hello? But I think what the caller brought up, Monsignor, is also indicative. I think she speaks for a lot of us who feel that we were under catechized, that we wanted something more. Thanks be to God for Relevant Radio.
You know, Becky, really, I hope she's still listening to us out there in the atmosphere, because her remarks, I think, speak to the common experience of so many, in that, yes, some of the reforms of the Second Vatican Council did bring a much closer encounter with the person of Jesus, sort of deinstitutionalized things and allowed for a different kind of conversion. And I think, for instance, of things like the charismatic movement, which took hold in the church and influenced wonderful places like Franciscan University of Steubenville and other movements of the church, that's tremendous. Along with that, Because there wasn't as deep of a focus, we had talked earlier, you and I, John, about the Baltimore Catechism and the memorization of the faith and the depth that sometimes comes from that. Because there wasn't as much of a focus on catechesis, there was a confusion, and I think Becky's story of going off to college, meeting other evangelically minded people and finding that they were all with Campus Crusade or something like that did cause many people to find themselves outside of the communion of the church. And so, you know, Pope Francis has recently talked about how it does take time for the effects of a council to be fully seen. And if you look in history, you often do find that there's tumult and turmoil both before and after a council, and that typically it does take some generations for the full effects of what the Holy Spirit was doing in a council to take hold. And that means that in the midst of it all, we need to both have a personal relationship with the Lord, and we have to know our faith inside and out and experience the beauty of it. And that includes the beauty, as you were saying earlier, in the liturgy, in sacred prayer, in all of the different aspects of it. And so personal conversion and depth of teaching are not mutually exclusive. And sometimes I think in the turmoil that followed in the years after the council, those things were made somehow to be enemies of each other, in the same way that some people make questions of peace and justice the enemy of traditional moral teaching.
Sure.
And of course, care for the poor and love for the unborn aren't mutually exclusive either. And so we have to get away from that simplistic thinking and reunite the teaching aspect of the church's fullness of truth.
Becky, I'm hopeful that helps. Thanks for listening to Relevant Radio in St. Charles, Illinois. God bless.
Thank you. You can still hear me?
I can hear you.
Ooh,
Becky.
Thank
you.
Okay,
yeah, she's there.
I wasn't. It sounded like maybe I had gotten cut off. I want to say that I value my entire experience because it is my Catholic faith. I am in love with it because I loved the Lord first. And so when I learned the truths, it made them so much more profound for me. So I just wanted to make that, you know, to reiterate, you know, or agree with Monsignor and that it actually ended up being a beautiful experience for me.
And living out another element of Vatican II is not only that personal call to holiness, but being a missionary and doing it through the radio. And of course, also using mass communications as a way to share the gospel message. Becky, thanks so much. Steve's in Boston, listening to Relevant Radio 1150. Hi, Steve. You're on with Monsignor Shea. Welcome to the Drew Mariani Show.
Oh, thank you. I don't really have a question. I have more of a comment. And
okay.
I grew up during the time that the Vatican Council was being carried out. And it was a confusing time. And I think that's the experience that I've had with it. I don't even remember the Latin Mass, although the Extraordinary Mass, I guess. But I know that my parents remembered that. And when the new Mass came in, it was kind of a shock to them. And I think part of that was we had never heard guitar strumming in the church, and just the atmosphere was so different. And one of the things, I love that idea of the continuity through the ages that you were talking about, that we were in a space that was a beautiful church with a beautiful altar. And it just invited this sense of worship. And the worship didn't seem consistent with the new Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And so my family ended up going to a Melkite rite. And I think there was a catechesis in the way the family, my parents, reacted to the new liturgy. And I got the sense that it wasn't reverential enough. And they didn't know Greek. The Melkite church was in at this church. It was Arabic.
Steve, let me just jump in here in the interest of time, because I want Monsignor Shea to react to what you said, because you're not alone and your parents were not alone at the time, even to today, Monsignor.
Well, yeah, I would say that Steve, your experience and the experience of your parents is not a unique one. I think that there were lots of people who experienced a particular kind of trauma and grief in the way that some of the liturgical reforms were implemented and felt like there was a real loss of reverence. And that's something, you know, if you come here, for instance, to the University of Mary, you'll see that we really take great pains to celebrate our masses with a whole lot of reverence and try and connect them to the deeper and the great tradition so that our students can see that we're in the worship of God and that the belief in the real presence in the Blessed Sacrament, for instance, are very important. And so, yeah, I think that reverence in the liturgy is tremendously important, and it was something many people experienced as going by the wayside in the years immediately following the Council.
That reform of the liturgy in Vatican II, and of course, the Eucharist being called the source and summit of faith, and also we learned the importance of family becoming the domestic church. So much to unpack still 60 years later with Vatican II. So blessed to have the perspective of Monsignor James Patrick Cheyenne, the president of the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota. Learn more at cometomary.com. That's cometomary.com. Monsignor, as always, thank you. Did it snow yet in Bismarck?
No, we're some time away from getting snow, but we have gotten a little bit of frost.
Okay, that's coming east, because I know in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan today, some places have as much as 6 to 8 inches of snow. Winter's on the way. Monsignor, as always, thanks. God bless. Look forward to our next conversation.
God bless you, John. Thanks.
John Harper in for Drew this afternoon here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.